Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Sunday, December 26th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. French Guiana Telescope Rockets to New Mission by Dennis Overby and Joey Roulette. Learning in a Pandemic, We're Not Back to Normal Yet at All by Jessica Seaman. Pope Prays for Healing and Peace by Gia Pianigiani and Elisabetta Provoledo. Biden's Make Calls to Service Members by Alexandra Jaffe. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Telescope Rockets to New Mission. International project will seek the earliest, most distant stars and galaxies by Dennis Overby and Joey Roulette, The New York Times Company. The dreams and work of a generation of astronomers headed for an orbit around the sun Saturday in the form of the biggest and most expensive space-based observatory ever built, the James Webb Space Telescope, a joint effort of NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency, lifted off from a spaceport near the equator in Corot, French Guiana, a teetering pillar of fire and smoke, embarking on a million-mile trip to the morning of time. The world gave us this telescope, and we're handing it back to the world today, Gregory Robinson, the Webb Telescope's program director, said during a post-launch news conference in French Guiana. The telescope, named for the NASA administrator who led the space agency through the early years of the Apollo program, is designed to see farther in space and further back in time than the vaunted Hubble Space Telescope. Its primary light-gathering mirror is 21 feet across, about three times bigger than Hubble, and seven times more sensitive. The Webb's mission is to seek out the earliest, most distant stars and galaxies, which appeared 13.7 billion years ago, burning their way out of a fog left over from the Big Bang, which occurred 13.8 billion years ago. Astronomers watching the launch remotely from all over the world, many zooming together in their pajamas, were jubilant. What an incredible Christmas present, said Garth Illingworth of the University of California, Santa Cruz. Todd Lauer of the National Science Foundation's Muir Lab, in an email exchange with other astronomers, reported his feelings about the launch. Just enjoying the most sacred of all space worlds, nominal, he said, referring to the lingo used by launch teams to describe rockets operating as expected. To which Alan Dressler, a Carnegie Observatory's astronomer and one of the founders of the Webb Telescope Project, replied, "Hallelujah, another sacred word for the moment, Todd." Priya Vada Natarajan, a cosmologist at Yale University, emailed from India to describe herself as just utterly, utterly elated. Wow, wow. In Baltimore, at the Space Telescope Science Institute, the headquarters for Webb's mission operations, a small group of scientists and NASA officials erupted in screams of joy and applauded as they watched video of the telescope's launch. The flight operations team in another part of the institute then watched as Webb deployed its solar array, then its communications antenna, minutes later. About 100 mission personnel will command the spacecraft's deployments, alternating between 12-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, throughout the process, as it begins its journey to a point beyond the moon. They've got real work to do, said Kenneth Sembach, the Institute's director. Our teams have spent the last 2 years doing numerous rehearsals. Equipped with detectors sensitive to infrared or heat radiation, the telescope will paint the universe in colors no human eye has ever seen. The expansion of the universe shifts the visible light from the earliest, most distant galaxies into the longer infrared wavelengths. Studying the heat from these infant galaxies, astronomers say, could provide important clues to when and how the supermassive black holes that squat in the centers of galaxies form. Closer to home in the present, the telescope will sniff at the atmospheres of planets orbiting nearby stars, looking for the infrared signatures of elements and molecules associated with life, such as oxygen and water. The Webb will examine all of cosmic history, billions of years of it, astronomers say, from the first stars to life in the solar system. This past week, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson called the telescope a keyhole into the past. It is a shining example of what we can accomplish when we dream big, he said. After the launch, he said, it's a great day for planet Earth. The beginning of the telescope's journey did not go unnoticed by the space agency's paymasters in Congress, who have stuck with the project for decades now. Today's successful launch of the James Webb Space Telescope marks a historic milestone in our advancement of astrophysics and space science, Representative Eddie Bernice Johnson, a Democrat of Texas, leader of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, said in a news release. Saturday's successful launch caps an expensive effort that stretched over 25 years of uncertainty, mistakes, and ingenuity. Webb's 18 gold-plated hexagonal mirrors, advanced temperature controllers, and ultra-sensitive infrared sensors were pieced together in a development timeline filled with cost overruns and technical hurdles. Engineers had to invent 10 technologies along the way to make the telescope far more sensitive than Hubble. When NASA picked Northrop Grumman to lead Webb's construction in 2002, mission managers estimated that it would cost $1 billion to $3.5 billion and launch to space in 2010. Over-optimistic schedule projections, occasional development accidents, and disorganized cost reporting dragged out the timeline to 2021 and ballooned the overall cost to $10 billion. Even its final lap to the launch pad seemed perilous as a mishap in the Kourou rocket bay, disconnected cables, and worrisome weather reports moved the Webb's departure date deeper into December, until a Christmas morning launch could not be avoided. I'm so happy today, said Joseph Aschbacher, Director General of the European Space Agency. But he added, it's very nerve-wracking. I couldn't do launches every single day. This would not be good for my life expectancy. For astronomers and engineers, the launch was also a suspenseful sight to take in. It was hard to sleep last night, said Adam Rees, an astrophysicist and Nobel laureate who will use the Webb telescope to measure the expansion rate of the universe. But the launch itself is only the first step in an even more treacherous journey that astronomers and rocket engineers have called 6 months of anxiety. The solar panel deployment, a half hour into the flight, was the first in a month-long series of maneuvers and deployments with what NASA calls 344 single points of failure. I could finally start breathing again when the solar arrays came out, said Pam Melroy, NASA's deputy administrator. We have so many hard days ahead of us, but you can't even get started on any of that until this part goes perfectly. Among the most tense moments, astronomers say, will be the unfolding of a giant sunscreen the size of a tennis court, designed to keep the telescope in the dark and cold long enough so that its own heat doesn't swamp the heat from distant stars. The screen is made of 5 layers of a plastic called Kapton, which is similar to Mylar and as flimsy as Mylar. It has occasionally ripped during rehearsals of its deployment. If all goes well, astronomers will start to see the universe in a new light next summer. They are most looking forward to what they didn't expect. As Thomas Zurbuchen, NASA's Associate Administrator for Science, said recently, every time we launch a big, bold telescope, we get a surprise. This one is the biggest and boldest yet. But if anything goes wrong in the coming weeks and months, the field of astronomy's view of the origins of existence may be imperiled. When problems snarled the work of the Hubble in the 1990s, NASA sent astronauts in space shuttles to perform repair work. The Webb telescope is headed to a point beyond the moon where no spacecraft has ever carried humans before. Learning in a pandemic. We're not back to normal yet at all. Students reflect on COVID-19 and the return to classrooms by Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Colorado students returned to the classroom this fall after a tumultuous school year that included frequent switches between in-person and online classes, or entirely virtual schooling, as COVID-19 cases repeatedly disrupted learning. And now, the 2021-22 school year has its own challenges. Schools face widespread staffing shortages that have led some to cancel classes or move them online. Districts and parents have debated having students wear masks after schools required face coverings amid another surge in COVID-19 cases, one that hit children particularly hard as schools remain the primary hotspot for outbreaks. Schools are also bracing for a new wave caused by the fast-spreading Omicron variant. Through all of this, little has been heard from those most affected by the policies and decisions. The students. The Denver Post spoke to 8 of them about how they are adjusting to being back in school and learning during a pandemic. All said they were excited to be back among their classmates and teachers. 2 even said that they were excited to write with pencils and paper once again instead of a keyboard. Most added they were able to focus more inside the classroom, but some said they had to adjust to the workload as they try to catch up on what they missed last school year. Most of the children and teens said they understood why they have to wear masks, even those who find face coverings annoying. 2 notice their schools are struggling to find substitutes for their classrooms when a teacher is absent. Here are their stories on what it is like to be in school right now and how the first half of the 2021-22 school year is going. Sienna Yeh. When Colorado first moved classes online in March 2020, Sienna Yeh was a third grader who liked to have sleepovers with her friends. Now, almost 2 years later, the 10-year-old is back in the classroom for the first time since the pandemic began. Sienna returned to Denver's Brown International Academy this summer before classes started. And once she was inside the building, memories came flooding back to her. She remembered the school's staircase and how classrooms actually have 2 doors instead of 1. Sienna's sleepovers are still on hold, but the fifth grader now sees and talks to her friends at school between assignments and class, during lunch period, and at recess, an activity she greatly missed when classes were online during her fourth grade year. "I get to see them like their full body," said Sienna, who became used to seeing her classmates only from their shoulders up on a computer screen. "That's super important because I know they're there and I can talk to them if I need to, and during recess, I get to play with them." Sienna prefers being back to school in person because she gets to write with pencils and paper, and she thinks she's learning more in class. She knows teachers are trying to catch students up on all they missed during the first year of the pandemic, but she's not too stressed. It's not like the remote learning when she would wait until each Friday just before her assignments were due to complete them. "It's a lot easier to focus when there's not a bag of chips downstairs in the pantry," Sienna said. "Last year, we didn't learn. I know we didn't learn as much as we would have if we were in person, and this year, we're kind of trying to catch up." Sienna noted the effects of the nationwide substitute teacher shortage in the classroom. Her teacher was absent a few times, and one week, the class cycled through about five subs, she said. Sienna also had to adjust to the longer days that come with being back in person and having less time for lunch, about 15 or 20 minutes, than she did when she was at home and could eat while doing her homework. Unless the weather is bad, lunches take place outside, one of the school's policies to help protect students from the virus. So Sienna normally sits on the sidewalk curb with her friends and their lunch trays, where they can see students in other grades run around in recess. When I eat inside, it's kind of weird walking down through the halls or through the lunch tables, seeing everybody without their masks, because I haven't seen that in a long time, other than at recess, Sienna said. But she said she feels more comfortable at school than she did at the start of the year because she just became fully vaccinated. It's not exactly back to normal yet, but it does feel as close to normal as we'll get for now because we're all trying to be safe, Sienna said. I've gotten used to masks a lot over the past year and a half. I don't even have to think about it. Arlie Lopez was excited to return to in-person classes for her senior year at Bruce Randolph School in Denver, as it meant being surrounded by her friends and teachers once again. During the first year and a half of the pandemic, Arlie spent her days locked in her bedroom with the family dog and a computer, trying to complete school assignments away from the noise of a full house. Her brother attended online school as well, and her parents also spent their days at home as Arlie's father, a handyman, couldn't find jobs because people either weren't comfortable with having others in their home or they were sick with the virus. Her father was also at high risk of developing complications from COVID-19 because of a heart condition. Arlie and her brother knew their parents struggled to pay rent and bills. We would be stressed for them because there's nothing we can do at all, Arlie, 18, said. Everybody in my household was just stressed with school and money. Arlie felt sad and lonely, and she cried a lot. But that changed after she returned to in-person school this fall, Arlie said. She thinks she is learning better and finds it easier to ask her teachers questions. She has plans to attend prom in the spring, the main event of senior year, and is preparing to go to college. She wants to become a nurse. Now I feel as if I'm doing better than I was before, Arlie said. I still do feel stressed sometimes, but I think that's completely normal. The return to school was not without its challenges. I feel behind a lot in certain points, Arlie said. Like with math, I really struggled with it last year. Sometimes about math, I just couldn't do it, and now I come back and I'm taking a college course, so it's really fast paced. Sometimes I don't feel like I was prepared enough last year. Signs of the pandemic are still visible in the school's hallways. Students wear masks and eat outside. There are coronavirus outbreaks. One of Arlie's teachers was absent for days with COVID-19 and for other personal reasons, meaning the class had to watch instructional videos. People say, oh, we're back to normal. We're not back to normal yet at all, Arlie said. And it's really just difficult going from online to in-person because we sort of adapted in a way to doing online. Derasia Miller missed out on her freshman year of high school. The 16-year-old spent the year attending classes online last year because of the pandemic. She didn't get to meet anyone, teachers or friends, during her first year at North High School in Denver. She didn't even know there was a track team. I was kind of sad because I was like, I'm supposed to be enjoying high school, Derasia said. Now, the teenager says she feels like time is moving too fast. It feels like high school is almost over, even though she's just a sophomore. Derasia returned to in-person classes in the fall, as Colorado schools have sought to keep their doors open despite the constant presence of COVID-19 in the state. She likes attending school in person, saying it's much better than virtual classes. She got to meet her teachers. She made more friends than she expected and plans to try out for the track team. Duraja is starting to think about college again and wants to become a labor and delivery nurse. Still, the return to school has had its challenges. Duraja says she is tired of the masks students have to wear, even though she understands why face coverings are required. She found it is harder to engage in her schoolwork and sit in classes for long periods. Her handwriting isn't as good as it once was after a year of doing projects on a computer. It's very hard for me to just sit in one spot for a long time because I always want to get up and move, Duraja said. There's a lot of homework, especially in her honors and advanced placement classes. Duraja is worried about her grades because she hasn't made all A's and B's this semester, as she normally does. She doesn't want her GPA to be under 3.5. It's currently a 3.3. I'm trying to balance everything out with my personal life and then my school life, Duraja said. It's okay. It's just a little stressful because I'm not used to it. Mackenzie, Addison, and Reagan Forrest. 10-year-old Mackenzie Forrest and her two younger sisters are having a pretty good time at Hopkins Elementary School in Centennial. The youngest, 5-year-old Reagan, just started kindergarten, so she is too young to know what it is like to go to school while not in a global pandemic. But she said she has made a lot of friends so far this year. It's fun because I get to do fun stuff and I get to go out in my playground, Reagan said. But Mackenzie and her sister Addison, 7, remember a time when COVID-19 didn't exist, and they used to move around more freely in school without having to distance themselves from their classmates. When in-person classes resumed in late 2020, students had to sit at separate tables and wear masks, they said. Everything changed from the pandemic, said Addison, a second grader. Both sisters said the school has improved since the 2020-2021 year. Neither spent much time in remote learning last school year, but they said they can now move around more freely in the building, and Mackenzie's class had a field trip, her first since the pandemic began, planned in mid-December. The school also recently hosted its first book fair, which was exciting because Addison had never been to one before. I think people should know that in-person is easier to learn because you can hear the teacher better, Mackenzie said. The fourth grader felt the effects of the substitute shortage, saying when her teacher was absent from school and they couldn't find a substitute to cover the class, a teacher from another class filled in while still overseeing another class. The teacher went from room to room every few minutes to check on students. She would be telling her class what to do, and then we would just have to be waiting, Mackenzie said. The sisters started the school year without wearing masks, but as COVID-19 cases began rising among students after classes started back, their parents had them put face coverings back on. Some of their classmates didn't wear masks until Littleton Public Schools told students they were required, Addison said. Addison said she didn't feel good when she learned that there was an increase in cases among children. I just want every kid to get vaccinated and every person in the United States to get vaccinated because then COVID would be gone, she said. COVID changed our lives for 2 years or so. Jonah and Avery Remy. For 10-year-old Jonah Remy, the most challenging aspects of school during the pandemic are the mask he has to wear each day and how some days his friends miss school because they are sick or quarantining. It's really tough to be in person, the fifth grader said. Maybe one of your friends is sick and they're not at school and you don't really have any other friends. Jonah said it's good that students wear masks, but they are annoying. You can't really breathe through them that much, and it's really hard to hear people when you talk through your mask, so teachers can't really hear you when you answer a question. So it's kind of real hard, he said. Jonah attends Leawood Elementary in Littleton with his younger brother, Avery, and is considered the scholar of the family. So much so that he liked virtual learning, which he did for a few months in 2020 because there were fewer distractions. "It's fun," he said. "You learn a lot of stuff since you're not really with your friends, so you can't really talk that much. I think you learn more in remote learning than you do in person." Jonah and Avery said that other than the masks they wear and having to eat lunch outdoors, they don't think about the virus much while in school. "It doesn't scare me, but I'm just really worried about it," said 8-year-old Avery, a second grader. "I don't want people getting sick." Vatican. Pope prays for healing and peace by Gia Pianigiani and Elisabetta Povoledo. The New York Times Company, byline Rome. Pope Francis used his annual Christmas message Saturday to pray for the many whose lives have been upended by the pandemic and to urge the world's leaders to engage in patient dialogue, to end conflict and encounter others and do things together at a time when so many are forced to be apart. In his address, Francis called on Jesus to grant health to the infirm and inspire all men and women of goodwill to seek the best ways possible to overcome the current health crisis and its effects. He reiterated pleas that COVID-19 vaccines be made available to all, and he asked Jesus to comfort the victims of violence against women, which has increased in this time of pandemic, a scourge that he recently denounced as almost satanic. It was the second year that the pandemic had held sway in the Pope's Christmas message. But in a sharp contrast to last year, when he made the address from within the Apostolic Palace, surrounded by only a few because of coronavirus restrictions, this year, Francis spoke from the central balcony of St. Peter's Basilica to thousands of faithful present in the adjacent square. Such outdoor gatherings are prohibited in Italy, which was hit this past week by a steep surge in coronavirus cases. But Vatican City, which sets its own rules, allowed the crowd to gather Saturday for the Pope's Christmas address. Those present were required to wear masks and respect distancing, noting that many conflicts, crises, and disagreements have continued during the pandemic. Francis said there was a risk that by now we hardly even notice them. "We have become so used to them that immense tragedies are now being passed over in silence," he said. "We risk not hearing the cry of pain and distress of so many of our brothers and sisters." He cited the decade-long conflict in Syria, tensions in Iraq, the enormous tragedy of Yemen, the very troubling economic and social conditions in Lebanon, the targeting of Christians in Myanmar, and the plight of Afghans, who for more than 40 years have been sorely tested by conflicts that have driven many to leave the country. He also turned to the Middle East, where tensions persist between Israelis and Palestinians, with ever more serious social and political consequences, while Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, struggles with the economic repercussions of the pandemic because tourists no longer visit. And in a nod westward, Francis said, "Grant that through dialogue, mutual respect, and recognition of the rights and cultural values of every human being, the values of solidarity, reconciliation, and peaceful coexistence may prevail in the hearts of the people of the Americas." He called on Jesus to bring peace to the world, to sustain all those who provide humanitarian aid to peoples forced to flee from their homelands, to prevent fresh outbreaks of a long festering conflict in Ukraine, and to help Ethiopia find once again the path of reconciliation and peace. As he has before, Francis also urged the world not to remain indifferent before the tragic situation of migrants, displaced persons, and refugees. The address, known as the Urbi et Orbi, was one of solidarity and community. "Our capacity for social relationships is sorely tried," the Pope said. "There is growing tendency to withdraw, to do it all by ourselves, to stop making an effort to encounter others and do things together. This applies not only to personal relationships," he said, "but also on the world stage. On the international level, too, there is a risk of avoiding dialogue, the risk that this complex crisis will lead to taking shortcuts rather than setting out on the longer paths of dialogue, Francis said. Yet only those paths can lead to the resolution of conflicts and to lasting benefits for all. Biden's Make Holiday Calls to Service Members by Alexandra Jaffe, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden marked his first Christmas in office by making calls to military service members stationed around the world, offering them holiday wishes and gratitude for their service and sacrifice for the nation. Joined by his wife Jill and their new puppy, Commander, the president on Saturday spoke via video to service members representing the Army, Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, Space Force, and Coast Guard, stationed at bases in Qatar, Romania, Bahrain, and the U.S. As your commander-in-chief, I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you, thank you, thank you, he told the service members. We're grateful for your courage, your sacrifice, not only your sacrifice, but your family's sacrifice. Speaking from a studio set up at the White House, Biden told them they're the solid steel spine of the nation and emphasized the truly sacred obligation the nation has to care for soldiers and their families. Jill Biden expressed empathy for the difficulties their families experience spending the holidays away from their loved ones, noting that the Bidens experienced the same when their son, Beau, who served as a major in the Delaware Army National Guard, was deployed to Iraq. The Bidens planned a relatively quiet Christmas at the White House with family. On Friday night, the President and the First Lady participated in Holy Trinity's Christmas Eve Mass virtually in the East Room, according to the White House, and held a pasta dinner and sleepover with their children and grandchildren, a Biden family tradition. As the pandemic surges anew, driven by the highly infectious Omicron variant, the Bidens sought, with their public appearances and statements, to offer a sense of unity and normalcy in an otherwise challenging season for many. In a Christmas statement, the Bidens praised the enormous courage, character, resilience, and resolve of the American people in the face of the pandemic and offered prayers that the nation would find light in the darkness during a difficult season. During this season of joy, we are inspired by the countless Americans who are a reminder that the things we hold sacred unite us and transcend distance, time, and even the constraints of a pandemic, the Bidens said in their statement. And the call to soldiers was just the latest Christmas tradition the two participated in, after spending Christmas Eve spreading holiday cheer around Washington. On Friday morning, they visited Children's National Hospital to offer holiday greetings to young patients and their families. The president showed off photos of their new puppy, and Jill read a children's book to patients. Later, the two stopped by a Jill Biden-themed Christmas tree in the DuPont Circle neighborhood. The president hung the 2021 White House Christmas ornament amid branches decked out with photos of his wife's face, apples, and small chalkboards in homage to her teaching career. Both answered calls to the North American Aerospace Defense Command's Santa Tracking Service, speaking to parents and children about their Christmas wish lists. As Omicron spreads, unvaccinated remain defiant, by Jack Healy, Noah Whelan, and Richard Fawcett. The New York Times Company, Byline, Cleveland. As a fast-spreading new strain of the coronavirus swarms across the country, hospitals in Ohio, running low on beds and workers, recently took out a full-page newspaper advertisement pleading with unvaccinated Americans to finally get the shot. It read simply, "Help." But in a suburban Ohio cafe, Jackie Rogers, 58, an accountant, offered an equally succinct response on behalf of unvaccinated America. "Never. In the year since the first shots began going into arms, opposition to vaccines has hardened from skepticism and wariness into something approaching an article of faith for the approximately 39 million American adults who have yet to get a single dose. Now health experts say the 15% of the adult population that remains stubbornly unvaccinated is at the greatest risk of severe illness and death from the Omicron variant and could overwhelm hospitals that are brimming with COVID-19 patients. In Cleveland, where Omicron cases are soaring, a hospital unit at the Cleveland Clinic that provides life support to the sickest patients is completely full. Compounding the problem, the pace of first-time vaccinations appears to be plateauing this month, even as Omicron takes hold, and the numbers of children getting vaccinated and eligible adults getting booster shots are lower than some health experts hoped. About 20% of children 5 to 11 years old have gotten a dose of vaccine, and only about 1 in 3 vaccinated Americans has gotten a booster. It is still too early to know whether spiking numbers of Omicron infections in New York, the rest of the Northeast, and the Midwest will be followed by a surge in hospitalizations and deaths. Early studies suggest the new variant may cause less severe illness than previous variants did. But so far, the threat of Omicron is doing little to change people's minds. Nearly 90% of unvaccinated adults said the variant would not spur them to get shots, according to a recent survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation. And some of the unvaccinated said that Omicron's wily ability to infect vaccinated people only reaffirmed their decision to not get the shot. Others say the virus's changing nature has stiffened their resolve not to get it. "It's just another variant," said Diane Putnam, an unvaccinated resident of Dalton, Georgia, and president of her county's Republican Party, who spent 6 days in the hospital this summer after contracting COVID-19. "Next year, there will be another one. I mean, it's always going to be different variants." Public health campaigns and employee vaccine mandates have made progress since the summer at reducing the ranks of unvaccinated fence-sitters, people without easy access to health care, and those who were hesitant but persuadable. The remaining ranks of unvaccinated Americans steadfastly opposed to getting a shot tend to be younger, whiter, and more Republican than those who have received the vaccine or are still considering one, surveys show. At least 6 million first doses have been given in December since Omicron was first detected in the United States. But those numbers come with a caveat. Boosters can sometimes be misclassified as first doses, potentially leading to an overcount of how many Americans are getting their first shots, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has warned. Booster shots, now the preoccupation of many state and federal health officials, have made up a greater portion of the 1.5 million doses administered each day around the country in recent weeks. The rate of first doses given was similarly sluggish in the late summer, when about 300,000 were given each day, dropping even more before regulators authorized the Pfizer-BioNTech shot for young children in October, when the rate of first doses began climbing again. The number of adults vaccinated has grown steadily since 6 months ago, when approximately 170 million had received a first shot, compared with around 220 million Saturday, an increase driven in part by mandates. Low vaccination rates are still heavily concentrated in rural areas and the South, with Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas, and Alabama near the bottom. Those states have recorded around half of their population as vaccinated, well below the national rate of about 62%. In interviews across the country, unvaccinated people said they had grown inured to public health messages from exhausted doctors and nurses, and even pleas from their own families, as vaccinations have become entangled in the country's politics. Even though mandates have been shown to improve vaccination rates significantly in places and at companies that enact them, they said they were dead set against President Joe Biden's efforts and had tuned out his appeals for Americans to get vaccinated as a patriotic duty. "The nail in the coffin was when they said you had to get the vaccine. It definitely turned me away," said Ciara Bricker, 26, a sales representative in Fort Worth, Texas. The United States continues to see a stark partisan divide in vaccination rates, with more than 91% of adult Democrats receiving at least one shot, compared with about 60% of adult Republicans. In the past week, former President Donald Trump made two full-throated endorsements of vaccines that many of his supporters have rejected, drawing praise from Biden. At an event in Dallas last Sunday, he argued that a shot in the arm was a way to help demonstrate that the three vaccines, which were developed while he was in office, were one of his great successes. Trump also promoted the vaccines in a video interview released this past week by the Daily Wire, a conservative media site, while also rejecting the idea of mandates. "Forget about the mandates. People have to have their freedom," Trump said. "But at the same time, the vaccine is one of the greatest achievements of mankind." Dr. Jose R. Romero, the Arkansas Health Secretary, said his state's vaccination rate, which is hardly budging, reflected how deep the opposition to the shot was among those left to convince. "Unfortunately, we can't say that we've identified a single thing that has really moved the needle to any great extent," Romero said. "It's just a slow chipping away at this. It's sort of a mouse eating the elephant one bit at a time. And you just keep going." In Washington, as the Supreme Court is set to hear challenges to the Biden administration's vaccine mandates, White House officials see few remaining policy levers to pull. Domestic airline passenger vaccination requirements are one of the few tools still at Biden's disposal that could meaningfully increase the ranks of the vaccinated. But the administration does not have plans to enact them for now, senior officials said. "Pure persuasion, I think we've run out of options," said Dr. Anthony Fauci, Biden's chief medical advisor. "There were still glimmers of hope," he added. "Some people fearful of Omicron would take the leap. And unvaccinated Americans," he said, "were still not a one-dimensional group. Some might need to just see more safety data," he said. Like some other public health experts, Fauci said that a uniform federal vaccine passport system could be another resource. "If more businesses and organizations ask for passports under that kind of program," he said, "a lot of people are going to realize that it's so inconvenient not to be vaccinated that they might as well go ahead." But unvaccinated people, such as Eric Diltz, 45, a DoorDash delivery worker in St. Joseph, Missouri, said he felt like the imperfect nature of the vaccines and shifting messages from public officials about boosters and breakthrough infections had validated his skepticism. "Now you need a first shot and a second shot, and now they're talking about all these boosters," he said. "How many shots do you need? It seems like a joke to me." Unvaccinated Americans this year have made up the vast majority of severe cases and deaths from the virus. And health experts say getting vaccinated remains the best way to protect against severe illness and death. The unvaccinated are much more likely to be in a hospital, and they're much more likely to be taking up a bed that might be wanted this winter, said Bill Hanage, a public health researcher at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Instead, many of the unvaccinated have placed their faith in natural immunity in weathering COVID-19 so far, despite warnings from infectious disease experts that the body's protections are not sufficient to ward off reinfection. In Los Angeles, Marie Elena Rigo, 51, who contracted COVID-19 in January, said she felt protected after testing for antibodies and was more skeptical of the vaccine after a flurry of recent breakthrough infections among friends and family. Her 11-year-old son tested positive Wednesday. "He coughed on me last night when I hugged him," she said. "I don't feel scared. I never was scared." Dr. Luciana Borio, a former chief scientist at the Food and Drug Administration who advised Biden during the transition, said reaching the unvaccinated was now arguably the hardest aspect of the U.S. response, one that would require a change of course in federal and state priorities, such as reopening community vaccine sites or urging providers to put more focus back on first doses. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services pointed to a wide-ranging vaccine public education campaign still underway at the agency, with special attention now to reaching young children and those in need of a booster. New ads this past week targeting rural younger Americans featured the language, "When you're done with COVID, it doesn't mean it's done with you." Other ads targeting rural adults warned of the financial costs of contracting the virus. In Cleveland, the COVID-19 picture is one of the bleakest in the country. Intensive care units are crammed with patients with the Delta variant, with a surge of new Omicron infections looming. New infections in Cuyahoga County, which includes Cleveland, have grown by 234% in the past 2 weeks. Ohio, where 60% have gotten at least one shot, now has the country's highest rate of COVID-19 hospitalization. And doctors say emergency rooms and ICUs are running out of beds. They are being forced to call people in from holiday vacations as growing breakthrough infections whittle away at their staff levels. In news briefs, man killed in shark attack. A man who had been on a boogie board off the coast of Central California died after he was apparently attacked by a shark near Morro Bay, authorities said Friday. The man, whom authorities did not identify, was found floating and unresponsive off Morro Strand State Beach about 10:40 a.m. and was pronounced dead at the scene, according to a statement from California State Parks. If confirmed, the attack would be the first fatal shark attack in the United States in 2021, according to an incident log kept by the Global Shark Attack File, which tracks data on interactions between humans and sharks. The log indicates there have been 8 fatal attacks this year worldwide, including 3 in Australia. There were 3 fatal attacks in U.S. waters in 2020, off Bailey Island, Maine, Maui, Hawaii, and near Santa Cruz, California. From 2011 to 2020, the United States had just 7 fatal shark attacks and 448 non-fatal attacks. Parts of California get a white Christmas. Byline, Los Angeles. Parts of California got a white Christmas as snowfall pounded mountains across the state. At Donner Pass in the Sierra Nevada, officials at the University of California's Central Sierra Snow Laboratory wondered on Twitter if the recent snowfall could break the record for the snowiest December of 179 inches set in 1970. There's been at least 119 inches recorded so far this month, according to the Mercury News, with more than expected over the next 48 hours. The snowpack in the Sierra was at dangerously low levels after recent weeks of dry weather, but the State Department of Weather Resources reported on Christmas Eve that the snowpack was between 114% and 137% of normal across the range, with more snow expected. In the San Bernardino National Forest, crews were working on a $4.2 million emergency project to repair a section of California 18 that washed down a hillside late Thursday after heavy rain, according to the San Bernardino Sun. The roadway is a major route to Big Bear Lake, and the closure near Panorama Point could be several days, if not weeks, the newspaper reported. Suicide bomber attacks bar, killing 6. Byline, Benny Congo. A suicide bomber attacked a restaurant and bar Saturday as patrons gathered on Christmas Day, killing at least 6 others in an eastern Congolese town where Islamic extremists are known to be active. Heavy gunfire rang out shortly after the bomb went off, with panicked crowds fleeing the town center. The attack marked the first known time a suicide bomber has killed victims in eastern Congo, where an Islamic State affiliate this year took responsibility for a suicide bombing near another bar in Beni that had caused no other casualties. The latest violence only deepens fear that religious extremism has taken hold in a region already plagued for years by rebels. Report. Women, children, among dozens killed in Myanmar. Government troops rounded up villagers, some believed to be women and children, fatally shot more than 30, and set the bodies on fire, a witness another report said Saturday. The purported photos of the aftermath of the Christmas Eve massacre in Eastern Moso Village, just outside Prusho Township in Kea State, where refugees were sheltering from an army offensive, spread on social media in the country, fueling outrage against the military that took power in February. The accounts could not be independently verified. The photos showed the charred bodies of more than 30 people in three burned-out vehicles. Flight cancellations snarl holiday plans for thousands. Byline, New York. Airlines continued to cancel hundreds of flights Saturday because of staffing issues tied to COVID-19, disrupting holiday celebrations during one of the busiest travel times of the year. FlightAware, a flight tracking website, noted nearly 1,000 canceled flights entering, leaving, or inside the U.S. Saturday, up from 690 flights scrapped on Friday. More than 250 flights were canceled for Sunday. Delta, United, and JetBlue said the Omicron variant was causing staffing problems, leading to flight cancellations. United spokesperson Maddie King said staffing shortages were still causing cancellations, and it was unclear when normal operations would return. According to FlightAware, the three airlines canceled more than 10% of their scheduled Saturday flights. American Airlines also canceled more than 90 flights Saturday, about 3% of its schedule. These were from Denver Post Wire Services. Denver's 2020 George Floyd protests. Majority of protest cases dismissed, by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. A year and a half after Denver police arrested hundreds of people during massive racial justice protests downtown, 33 people have been convicted of crimes related to the demonstrations. The large-scale protests began May 28th, 2 days after video showing a Minneapolis police officer murder George Floyd became public, and continued in Denver every night for more than a week. Thousands of people marched near the Capitol and through downtown, calling for racial justice and police reform in that time, and sporadic protests continued throughout the summer. Although the majority of the thousands of protesters remained peaceful, police arrested people carrying weapons and those who were suspected of throwing rocks and bottles, as well as hundreds who continued to protest after a curfew set by Mayor Michael Hancock. The District Attorney's Office and the City Attorney's Office provided the Denver Post with lists of protest-related prosecutions that combined totaled 389 cases. The cases involved incidents from May to September 2020. A majority of those cases were dismissed in June 2020 when the City Attorney's Office decided to drop charges against more than 300 people arrested solely for breaking curfew or failing to obey police orders. When she announced the decision, City Attorney Kristen Bronson said she recognized the importance of peaceful protest and dismissed the charges to pursue a non-punitive, restorative approach outside of the court system. The remaining cases range from municipal counts alleging public fighting to charges of attempted first-degree murder for two men who drove their vehicles into groups of people. Of the remaining 81 cases, 33 people were convicted at trial or through a plea deal. 15 people received deferred judgments, meaning their case will be dismissed if they successfully complete probation and other requirements. 11 cases were dismissed. One person was found not guilty at trial. 21 cases remain open. Sentences for those convicted of misdemeanors and felonies range between 10 days of home detention to 6 months in jail. Many will spend months or years on probation. Jesse Thomas was arrested May 29, 2020, while protesting for allegedly throwing a rock at a Denver Sheriff Department vehicle. Prosecutors with the District Attorney's Office charged him with misdemeanor criminal mischief, but dropped the case in November, court records show. Having a criminal case looming over his head stressed Thomas out, he said. He said prosecutors told him they were dropping the case for lack of evidence. It's kind of just been a nuisance, he said. Violent crimes. Of the 9 people facing criminal charges for alleged violent crimes, the most serious charges were filed against 3 people suspected of driving their vehicles into groups of people. Anthony Knapp faces charges including attempted murder for allegedly intentionally driving his car into a group of police officers on May 30th, 2020. Knapp struck 3 officers, breaking 1 officer's leg, according to police documents. Knapp pleaded not guilty to the charges at an arraignment, and the case remains open. Another man, Jacob Taylor, also faces attempted murder charges for allegedly driving into a group of protesters on June 28, 2020, near Larimer and 21st Streets. The Denver Police probable cause statement alleges a group of protesters near the intersection damaged the car Taylor was driving, and Taylor yelled, "I swear on my mama, I'm going to get all of you." Taylor then drove away but returned a short time later and at 30 miles per hour struck a man walking in a crosswalk. A police officer who witnessed the incident told investigators. Taylor fled the scene and abandoned the vehicle, but police found him later and arrested him. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.